Oh, hello, friends. It's your old pal, the Chris Keeper, here. I've just got a few snacks ready for tonight's showing of The Fog by John Carpenter. We're having a little viewing in the screening room of the Chris Keeper Mansion. I've got my friends, the Hair Metal Hero and El Jacone here. We're making some popcorn. I've got some soda pops. I thought I would set a good atmosphere and turn on the old smoke machine, but it wasn't working, so... improvise. I just hooked up a tube to old Cryptine, the old jalopy here, and we'll have that room smoked up real good in just a minute. Okay, guys, I got the popcorn in the... Guys? Guy? Oh, no.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
All right, it's been a little while because I've been on my podcast vacation, but finally we're back to the vault, the horror vault with the Hair Metal Hero and Luke, Jack, and Eddie, which is really one person. It's not Luke, Jack, and Eddie.
You know, not only have I been hearing that joke most of my entire life,
sure,
but I'm gonna tell you a little story that makes that even more bizarre. Okay, my brother is a high school math teacher. Okay, and his name is Jason Giaconetti, right? And at one point, he worked at a school, and there were two guys in the math department. It was him and the other guy. His name was Chris. His last name was Phil and Jerry.
Oh, no.
So it was Jason Giaconetti and Chris, Phil, and Jerry. It's like, oh, you got six people in that department.
Yeah, really. It's wow.
Awesome.
And say, well, it makes our show sound fuller.
Yeah.
Boy, this is an exciting one for me because I believe this is the only one on our list that I've never seen before. I don't even think I've seen like scenes from it before. It was like completely new and out of the blue for me. Which I can't tell you how awesome it was, especially seeing something with a young Jamie Lee Curtis and Adrian Barbeau in it.
Well, we're talking for our listeners, we're talking about The Fog,
yes,
made in 1979, which was Carpenter's first film after Halloween, which was the film that kind of skyrocketed him to the big time as far as the mainstream was concerned. And Chris is right, it's very interesting. You look at the three top-billed stars in this film are, in order, Adrienne Barbeau, Jamie Lee Curtis, and Janet Leigh.
Yeah.
And none of them have scenes
with
each other.
Right there.
Oh, that's right. You're right. They never were together at all, were they?
They're only together, and then not all three of them, but Jamie Lee Curtis and Janet Leigh are together at the very end in the church, but that's it.
Oh, okay. Wow. And come on, and talk about classy. You also thrown right on top of it. You got a big old fat John Houseman doing the sort of Donald Pleasance for this one.
Yeah, and Hal Holbrook.
Yeah, yeah.
When I watched this, Hal Holbrook, of course, plays Father Malone. And I was watching, thinking, you know, this is the role that Donald Pleasance should have played.
Yes.
And then I thought, we watched that. It was called Prince of Darkness.
You're right. You're right. But it was just, it was great. And he actually got Hal Holbrook reading, you know, what the major hinging part of his role is. He's reading out of this diary and reading aloud, which is just sort of Hal Holbrook. I'm like, oh my God, it's like Mark Twain's In the Fog reading out loud. This is how classy can you get, you know? Yeah, what a cast, you know? It's sort of like, I guess you can get this cast after having Halloween under your belt, but God, the expectations people had for this movie And this one's really like a small, well, you know, I mean, Halloween was a low budget movie too, but this one's a low budgeter too. And I just remember people being kind of underwhelmed by it, you know, when it came out. And maybe that's why I never had that interest in seeing it when I was younger, which I don't understand.
Well, you know, you may have a point, because one of the things I found interesting when I was watching the film for this episode was that, you know, this was rated R, and there's no blood in this film. There's no blood. There's no nudity. There's a little bit of implied sex, which I think is hilarious because what's their names? Elizabeth and Nick. As soon as they meet, after they, you know, he picks her up on the road. The next scene, they're in bed.
Well, she was picking up on him in the car. Yeah, they were totally flirting in the car. But it reminded me of a James T. Kirk scene. You know, it's like the implied sex. You know, they're putting on their boots afterwards. You know, it's you know, no nudity or anything like that. It's kind of coy so yeah,
there was a couple of uses of the S word. I think that was it. There wasn't even any F bombs. It's like, this would have a hard time getting a, this would be a PG-13 movie today. This film release, not the crap tech or remake.
You could run it on TV pretty much on anything, you know, uncut, I imagine.
Yeah, just got to cut over the profanity and you're good to go.
Yeah, I mean, they did reshoots to make it more violent, you know.
Which is amazing, because there's really not that much.
There's the ice stabby scene is the only one that really felt, you know, like a gore movie, you know, where they were stabbing out the kid's eyes. But
yeah,
and there's like an impalement, but that's kind of cartoony, you know. That's kind of, you know, it's not very shocking when, you know, in that kind of movie, you know, you've been seeing people run through with swords like that in pirate movies for, you know, since the 50s, since the 40s. So,
right.
Yeah,
but, you know, you're right. The trawler scene is very effective. And watching The Fog, you really can tell that Carpenter had just come off Halloween, because the two films are shot in a very similar way. They're both like the first segment of The Fog, when everything's going crazy for an hour in the town, and then the third segment, when it's nightfall, when the ghosts are coming out to take revenge. It's shot at night. There's a lot of minimal light. Mostly it's light from buildings or other incidental light.
Uh-huh.
It's very moody. It's got, you know, the very minimalist sort of Carpenter soundtrack over it, and he did write the soundtrack to this one. You know, so it reminds you of Halloween in that sense, because it looks very similar to Halloween. And structurally, it's set up like Halloween. In Halloween, we follow, you know, several different groups of characters whose narratives are independent of one another until they start crossing into each other. You know, in Halloween, we follow Loomis and Sheriff Brackett. We follow, you know, Laurie and Annie and them. And we follow, you know, Annie when she's babysitting. We follow Laurie when she's babysitting. And this one, we get the same thing. We get the different groups of characters who are kind of just going about doing their own thing until they all start intersecting as we get to the third act.
And I also noticed there were long stretches of this with no soundtrack and scoring, you know, just, you know, the ambient noise, which was sort of like common in horror movies in those days. And I always think that works really well, you know, when you have a lot of parts where everything is an underscore, then all of a sudden the music, when the music comes in this, it means the fog's coming in and people are going to start dying. I watched this on my way back from Florida on a bus between New York City and here, and it was great. I totally forgot that, you know, for an hour and a half that I was on a bus, you know, pretty miserable, you know, with a backache. And I loved it. I loved the way the fog looked compared to what I imagine. I was sort of talking about last episode, maybe watching the remake of it to compare them, but I never did it because I started thinking about when I was watching it on the bus, and I'm watching, you know, the fog roll in, and the fog just looks beautiful. I'm imagining they probably just made a miniature of, you know, the coastline and blew some dry ice over it or whatever that was backlit a little bit, but it just looked beautiful. It looked like a real fog rolling in, and I just started thinking about how in the remake it's got to be this, you know, CGI fog that curls spectacularly around everything and probably forms into the shapes of, you know, angry lepers and I don't want to see it.
Yeah, and you shouldn't. And in fact, I would make that recommendation for all of our listeners not to watch the remake of The Fog, because it's one of the things that I like about The Fog is that it's minimalist. You know, it's a minimalist film, and it doesn't beat you over the head with what's going on. Things happen that are subtle. The remake of The Fog is the exact opposite. There's not a subtle bone in that film's body, and it defeats the purpose, to me at least, of a ghost story if you're going to scream it from the rooftops. A ghost story needs to be subtle.
Yeah, and this one, I mean, it announces it right at the beginning with John Houseman telling the story that this is going to be a pretty traditional ghost story, and it is. And as such, it's a really good one, too. It's really scary, and it's builds the suspense masterfully. I love the whole thing of where, you know, the first night they're just pulling their energy. It's like they're pulling their energy from the town, you know. Everything's going haywire for that hour as they, you know, pull away the energy or messing with it somehow. And then, you know, the next night they can actually manifest. And you know, there's no part where they read something. They find things out by reading the journal and stuff, but there isn't someone saying, and then, you know, you'll feel a chill as they pull their power from, you know, or there isn't a character who articulates, you know, what's going on with this cold, and then, you know, electronics go haywire. You know, it just happens.
Yeah, it happens, and it's left for the audience to put two and two together. Which, you know, again, you could probably pull that off in 1979. In 2011, that might be a hard sell.
Yeah.
To the audience to put two and two together. But you know, that's brand for another occasion.
Yeah.
Yeah, there'd be a flashback and show you everything that happened.
You're right.
All kidding aside, there is a flashback in the remake of The Fog.
Yeah, all right.
They show the ship getting trashed on the rocks. They show, the fake fire. They show it all. And it's like, oh wow! I'm glad that, you know, you've told us everything that we need to know in the first, you know, 5 minutes of the film, because now I can turn it off.
Yeah, yeah.
Have to watch the rest of this crap.
It defeats the. I mean, that's the whole thing. There's this subtext of just the act of storytelling in this movie, you know, which means, say, you know, there's watching a movie, but there's also storytelling, which engages. Your imagination has to be engaged in order to work storytelling. So that was what was great about this movie, is half of it is a story that John Houseman told, you know, and then you put all that together in your head, and then the rest of it you see in the modern time. That's, you know, that's poetic, man. And
well, it's a basic. I mean, if you're watching a horror film and you're trying to identify with the potential victims that are there, isn't it scarier to be in the same boat as they are in terms of what you know and what you don't know?
Right.
And it's just common sense, or who the hell knows? Maybe it's not common sense. I mean, I'm not making money making movies, so.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's always the mad killer is always preceded by his campfire story, you know?
Right. That exists. They know that. You say that, and the first thing that pops into my mind, of course, Friday the 13th, Part 2. And how many times that flash back to in Part 2 specifically, where they talk about how, you know, they never found Jason's body and he still stalks these woods and all that. They referred to that in, like, almost all of the original series after that, because you need that. You need that you know, the film has to have its own mythology. The film has to have its own set of rules. And then, you know, typically the film will break them because most filmmakers aren't good enough to remember their own rules. But, you know, in this case, John Houseman tells a story at the beginning. We understand the setup. We don't know the details because we shouldn't know the details.
You don't need to.
Right. And to me, that's the same criticism, or not criticism, the same rebuttal of criticism I always throw at critics of Halloween 3, starring the dude who played, who's in this movie, Nick Castle, who was in Halloween 3.
Right.
And you get your Halloween and Halloween 3 mashup with him and Jamie Lee Curtis. But, you know, in Halloween 3, I always see people like, oh, well, it doesn't make any sense. How does a Celtic incantation turn kids' heads into bugs over the television? And they're like, well, it just does.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. I mean, you see it happen right there on screen. Come on.
Yeah, it's like, and they say, oh, well, they skirt the issue where the guy's saying a magician never tells his secrets. It's like, well, why would he tell him?
Yeah.
It's Celtic magic. I'm willing to accept that.
Yeah, I'm a soft sell with stuff like that, too. I mean, if you give me halfway plausible explanation, it just does it. Okay, it's fucking magic.
We don't need to have every... You know, it's like... I'm crossing the streams a lot here tonight. It's like people who complain about a lot of modern comics when there's references to things they don't know, and they're pissed off that those references aren't explained. It's like, you know, we used to do that back in the day. We went and found it out. And we didn't have the internet to do it either.
To go to the library, yeah.
It's like, you just follow along. Just figure it out, you know? You don't need everything spoon-fed to you. You should be a good enough reader, or in our case, on this podcast, a film viewer, to follow along the story. You shouldn't need to be spoon-fed. And if you're expecting to be spoon-fed, go watch something else. You know, that's get out of my theater.
There's plenty of places you can go get spoon-fed. I mean, I've just learned from being a long-time YouTube user. I've got so many videos up on YouTube's and on the YouTube's, and you go and read the comments on them, and people will be asking questions on it, and I'll realize these guys haven't even watched the video. You know, they look at it, look at the title, look at the picture, and then they like either dismiss it or embrace it and watch it, or they'll like ask, and I'll be like, there's an attention span of, you know, just a quarter of a second. It's amazing. So I guess the modern audience, I don't know if the modern audience loves to be spoon-fed or if they've just become used to it, because I think like a lot of writing has become very, very formulaic. You know, movie writing has become a lot more like TV writing, where authors, guys who are writing screenplays feel that they have to have a certain character arc and they have to have everything spelled out because it makes it easier for the audience. And they just, that just becomes the norm, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's sort of what's happened these days. And the audience can chew on more than, you know, what they're giving them, but they're just not used to it. I don't know even if they know if they're demanding it. I know audiences don't like to do things like, you know, read words at the same time that they're watching a movie, but...
Heaven forbid.
It's tough, I know.
It's awful. I blame the education system, but that's a story for another time.
Yeah. I will say we've talked a little bit about the trawler scene, and which is really the first really what do we talk about with Howard Hawks and the Things of Another World have two great scenes and no bad scenes.
Right.
That's your first great scene in The Fog, and what was impressive to me about that, watching it again, is that everything combines very effectively between the fog itself, between the light in the fog, and then you see the ship, you know, you see the Elizabeth Dane right come up on there, and then, you know, before you even have, you know, even a chance to think about that, then you see the figures in the fog coming forth, and all of it just builds and builds and builds until, you know, they the attack. And it's like, that's just classic suspense filmmaking right there. It's just piling one thing on top of another and just pushing and pushing and pushing. And it's like, that's just tremendous watching that, you know? And it's like, most modern filmmakers could learn that just from watching that little 5-minute clip, to learn how to build suspense in a way that's not artificial.
And at the same time, the thing about that is, to me, like, the whole idea of ghosts, you know, ghosts from the past wreaking their vengeance is kind of corny. So it's fighting against that with me. And, you know, when I was like, okay, so these are ghost lepers. But then once they show up, I was sold. You know, I was just like, man, it was nice. And, you know, it was truly, truly creepy. But it also, he had that feel of realism. Just the when the ship passes by them and they see it, and they're, you know, it's just registering in their brain that they saw this old sea ship go by them. It totally came off as how that would really play out in reality, and it felt real. And when you would see them just sort of coming out of the fog, they were really threatening, you know, like deadly quiet and just sort of showing up. It's sort of hard to sell a ghost story as being scary to me, you know, fun maybe, or like a good horror movie maybe, but actually truly suspenseful and scary, that's a hard sell, and this one totally pulled it off from beginning to end.
Yeah, I think that's due to the fact that the spirits don't talk at all. They just, I mean, that's frightening. If there's something that you can't reason with, can't talk to.
Yeah.
And it's not going to stop.
They're not humanized at all. Even though their situation is sympathetic, we know that, yeah, you know, the elders conspired against them and caused their death. We don't sympathize with them at all. You say that, like Hero says, they're completely inhuman and unrelatable.
Yeah. Oh, they'll kill a little old lady or a little kid if they get the chance. They'll kill anybody they get their hands on. You know. And it's
if,
like,
I ever make a movie, that's the first two kills. I'm going to kill an old lady and a little kid and then a puppy in the first 5 minutes.
Get them all out of the way.
Yep.
And you know what's sad is that more people will complain about you killing the puppy than about killing the little old lady or the kid.
Yeah, I love my mother's dog, but it's a dog.
It's funny. Scott and I had a very similar conversation on one of our Planet of the Apes commentary.
I couldn't kill an ape, though.
Oh, no, me neither.
They're too human.
There's an element of personality there.
Opposable thumb.
It's like in Pulp Fiction, you know. A dog has personality. You have to be one fucking charming pig, you know.
And I'll tell you what, most apes are going to kick our asses anyway. They are pretty damn strong, so, you know. I wouldn't want to mess with an ape unless it was really young or really old or really sick.
Or I had a gun.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck that. I want body armor.
Yeah, both of them.
First thing they go for is your eyes and your testicles. Fuck that. Then I can't look at porn and I can't beat off.
Exactly. It's just.
Well, you know, speaking of looking at porn, you alluded to this earlier, Chris, and I'm going to build on it. Oh, my God, does Jamie Lee Curtis look good in this movie?
Shit, that's classic Jamie Lee Curtis. It's actually, it's probably some of the trashiest Jamie Lee Curtis of all time. She's a little sketchy. Yeah, oh, yeah.
You can't be thinking about Laurie from Halloween. That's why
I got a little, you know, hint that maybe she's done her share of drugs or, you know, done some things that she probably isn't proud of, but not necessarily completely ashamed of. But the scene where they're like sort of feeling each other out in the car, you know, and she's trying to find out if he's a pervert, but at the same time, she's like kind of attracted to him. But I keep forgetting, in those days, guys that look like him weren't perceived as creepy as they're perceived these days.
Right, because that was a normal look.
That was just sort of the normal guy look. He's like a very typical, like, normal John Carpenter. He's very much reminds me of Rowdy Roddy Piper in They Live. And
yeah.
It's just sort of this barrel-chested, He's always pulling out a cigarette too to have a cigarette at key moments too. So he's definitely the John Carpenter proxy in this one.
Who's actually in the movie at the beginning?
Yeah,
he's the priest assistant
at the church.
Oh, was that John Carpenter?
Yep.
Oh, it makes sense. Yeah, I was like, that's kind of he had that 70s hippie priest look to him.
And actually, if we're talking about weird cameos, Tommy Wallace, who is one of the producers of Halloween and is also a producer of this film, he plays one of the ghosts. And then the head ghost, whose name I didn't bother to write down, is played by Rob Bottin, who of course wanted to do all the effects in the thing.
He's a large man.
But I was like, Rob Bottin. I just saw it in the credits. I'm like, really? I had to go look that one up.
Yeah, this was like John Carpenter just got he got his wife, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, and you know the woman from Psycho, and just had them. I love that there was sort of a little bit of a Halloween reference where, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis said something like, you know, trouble seems to follow me. And then the guy's body falls out on her. And the way his eyes are poked out, he totally looks like Michael Myers, you know. He looks like he's got the Michael Myers
and he's
mask
got
on.
Like the pale skin, like the shape mask.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And just the black holes for eyes and... It was a total, you know, Halloween sort of moment.
And if we want to take the Halloween connection one step further, Janet Leigh's assistant is played by Nancy Loomis, who played Annie Brackett in Halloween.
Yep. Oh, yeah, and then you get this typical Carpenter naming conventions. I mean, everybody's named after somebody he knows or somebody on the production.
And you know the mortician that they take the kid's body to is Dr. Fibes.
Yeah, yeah.
What his character's name is Dr. Fibes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, jeez. I love that scene. That was just a totally weird. That was
that's part of the reshoots.
Jaws. That was where I was like, this movie has some parallels to Jaws.
Yeah, that was part of the reshoots, actually.
Was it?
Yeah, I guess the movie clocked in at 80 minutes, which is too short to be a feature, apparently. And they went back and they filmed 10 minutes. The ghost story at the beginning by Houseman is part of it. The scene in the morgue is part of it. And then I think the scene at the end with Adrian Barbeau on top of the lighthouse is part of it as well.
Which is just a scene right there. You know, I remember the first time I watched this film was, I think I was in either 8th grade or 9th grade or something, and I was really starting to get into Carpenter and watch this movie on HBO with my dad and my mom. You know, that's a great, great group to watch a Carpenter film
yeah.
with. But, you know, so at the end when Adrian Barbeau is scrambling on top of the lighthouse and the ghost is chasing her up the steps, and then the other guy comes up behind her, my mom, like, lost it, you know? She's like, wah! You know? and that's just great.
That is awesome.
You know, and you know, the thing about Adrian Barbeau in this movie is that, you know, previously, this is actually the first Carpenter film we've watched for this series that actually has her physically appearing in it. Because,
right.
You know, in The Thing, she's the voice of the computer, the chess program. So I thought it was funny that most characters only know her as a voice, when the last time we saw her, she was just a voice.
That's true.
Here's a question for Luke. You'll probably know. Had Janet Leigh done any other thriller and/or horror films between Psycho and this?
No. No, Janet Leigh did mostly just great work. And in fact, I'm pretty sure she didn't appear in another horror-type film until she had her cameo in Halloween H2O.
Oh, jeez, I forgot all about that. Wow.
Because I'm pretty sure, anyway, and the thing that, you know, it's funny is because a lot of people don't put two and two together because she spells her name differently about the relationship between Janet Leigh and Jamie Lee Curtis and how they became kind of scream queen icons of different decades, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and they're linked together in this movie. And most people, I had forgotten that Janet Leigh was in this until I started doing my research before watching it. I'm like, oh, right, that's right, she's in this. But, now, Janet Leigh did not do a lot of this type of work, but, you know, she's always memorable when she does, and for a woman of her age at this time, she looks pretty damn good, I thought, too. So.
Yeah, it's surprising. There's
a lot of babage in this movie.
Well, I was looking at her, and I was going, well, you know what? Janet Leigh was probably not a hell of a lot older than I am at the time of this movie when I was watching. But that was another thing that was making parallels to Jaws. You had sort of the councilwoman character who was sort of, you know, shuffling things under, and, you know, the character who was suspicious of what's going on out there. And then that whole scene in the morgue just reminded me of the scene in Jaws where Hooper's going through the contents of the shark's stomach, where they're sort of talking about, you know, the gory details of things. And I was thinking, yeah, this is...
And then the morgue scene, the second half of it, when Nick is talking to Dr. Fibes, and I'm going to laugh every time I say that, while Elizabeth is still inside with the body, and the body gets up and is coming after her, you know, that, I mean, do you get a more classic setup, like straight out of the Universal Horrors than the body getting off the morgue and the girl not seeing it and sneaking up behind her? It's like James Whale could have shot that, you know?
Yeah.
But it works so well in this. It's like, you know, it's not unexpected, but it's done well, so it's appreciated.
Well, it's also a little callback to, it's got a little Halloween in it too, you know, where he's sort of like the guy with the ghost sheet over his head. He's shambling at her with a knife, and she's sort of, you know, not paying attention, and she's just sitting there being all like, hot.
Yeah, we know that Bob is dead, but. Oh, geez, help me out here. What's the third girl in Halloween? It's Laurie, Annie, and...
Linda. Linda, I think.
And Linda doesn't know that Bob is dead, but we certainly do.
Yes.
You know? So, you're like, turn around, you dumb idiot.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, she wanted her beer, man. Come on.
She just got laid, and she had her cigarette. So now she's got to call her girlfriend and gab about it.
Okay.
Like, ladies and gentlemen, I give to you the 1970s. Thank you very much.
I'm gonna have a little perv test on both of you.
Oh, Christ!
In that very scene, she's sitting there looking out the window with her arms crossed, and they're out in the, he's out in the hall talking. He goes, "Did you feel that? It got cold in here." And then you see her like shivering. Did anybody else, you know, take a look to see if maybe it was getting cold in there? That's the first thing I did. I was like, I wonder if Jamie Lee Curtis is method acting in this, because she should have really gotten some ice cubes. And
I'm almost embarrassed
right
that I didn't look.
Well, nothing happened either.
I didn't. I'm sorry. You're alone on that one.
I guess I don't know if I lose or win the perv test, but.
Well, I'll be completely honest with you. I was more waiting for the fact that I knew there was a POV shot from the corpse coming up where you see a great shot of her butt. So I don't know. Are we winners? Are we losers? Or is it like PCU that it doesn't matter who wins because we're all losers?
The thing with Jamie Lee Curtis is that this is really strange too. Is, you know, in order to see Jamie Lee Curtis nude, you really had to go to the comedies.
Trading Places.
That's where she would end up being nude, and it's usually the horror movies that have the actresses get naked in them. I guess maybe because she would survive the horror movies is.
Yeah, what's the line in Scream, you know, when they're watching Halloween at the party, and the guy goes, oh, I want to see Jamie Lee Curtis's tits. He goes, no, she didn't show her tits till she went legit.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And talking about, and just along that line of reasoning, again, Adrienne Barbeau is such a gorgeous woman.
It's
amazing to me that I intended to watch this film to talk about, you know, ghosts killing people, and instead I'm talking about women all the time. Carpenter is predictable in certain ways, I guess. I don't know.
Well, you know what she reminded me of in this? She reminded me of the DJ in the Warriors.
Yeah.
You know, I expected her almost to be like, so all you lepers out there, you know, don't be too hard on the townspeople. Remember, you only get six tonight. Ha, 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 ha.
Can you dig it?
Stay out of the fog tonight. Yeah.
Now that would make a movie right there. Mash up the Warriors and the fog.
Well, that radio station needed something, because I gotta say, it was awesome because Adrian Barbeau what seemed to be the sole DJ and owned and ran it. But
yeah.
And it was in a cool place. It was, you know, in the old lighthouse. You know, how much cooler of a radio station can you have? What a shitty radio station, though. You know, did you see the record collection there? I have a bigger record collection than that.
Well, apparently, we broadcast for like 5 hours a night, so
and
all that kind of, you know that mediocre, generic sound you've been looking for. Listen to this, you know.
Yeah.
And when she's not there, she's only got one. I don't care if it was the 70s. They did have tape loops that were longer than, you know, a 30-second just blip that would go over and over again. They had the technology that she could have put 50 of those carts in and just had 50 songs cycle through randomly. They had the tech. I saw it. She had the technology there, but no, she just put.
They had the technology, but the production didn't have the budget to buy the rights to songs. There you go.
There you go.
It's like watching a syndicated episode of WKRP in Cincinnati.
Oh, really? Do they cut out all the good rock and roll songs?
Yeah,
oh.
That's one of the reasons why I love WKRP in Cincinnati, but I've never bothered to buy it on DVD because all the music has been replaced with rock music.
Oh, my God. A lot of the great music that I discovered was through WKRP. I lived in such a backwater town that, like, the first time I heard The Who was on WKRP in Cincinnati. Sad.
You know, you talk about the radio station, and I don't know much about radio. It just looked a little low rent to me as well. So, but you know, the scene when she brings the piece of driftwood into the studio when she's listening to all the promos on the tape, and then you know, the water starts flowing out of the driftwood, and then it catches fire and all that.
Yes.
The scene of that, the water flowing off of the driftwood. It's another one, you know. It's been a running theme on this show that, you know, simple but effective.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, that is, it's a very simplistic effect, but that is so creepy in the context, you know, with the water suddenly pooling out of the wood, and the wood, you know, not being driftwood anymore. It's like, that's creepy as hell, you know. And then the fires, as everybody loves fires, so you got to throw that in there. So we can get the movie style shooting of the fire extinguisher, which is one long, two short. That's the way everybody shoots a fire extinguisher in the movie.
That's right. I've never thought of that. You're right.
And you know, we talk. You know, it's like we talk about on In the Mouth of Madness. He has to get the big bowl of popcorn. He goes to the movie theater. If a fire had broken out, he'd have shot the fire extinguisher the same way. So,
well, for such a shitty low budget radio station, at the same time, having your equipment doused in water and then fire like that, that was some good equipment because it was playing everything a little fast, but it was still playing after that and getting blasted by a fire extinguisher. So that's some pretty hardcore equipment there. But at the same time, that was one of my favorite parts because I love locations. I love great locations like that. And that was an awesome location because she had nowhere to go, you know?
Yeah.
She was stuck there. She was stuck there, and it served a great purpose to have her there because she could see where the fog was going and had the radio station to you know. And I love that the fog was just sort of, I thought the fog would just be sort of something that rolled in, that it wouldn't be this sort of traveling, you know, entity that was just sort of a localized thing that would just sort of show up to get people. I thought that was awesome.
I mean, it's, you know, there's, it's just, when at the end of the day, to me, the success of this movie is not just the technical merit of how it's shot, because this is a very well-made little ghost story, you know, but it's the creativity. It's the idea that it's not, you know, don't just, what we talk about, don't give, don't just spoon feed it, but let the audience, you know, think about it. Give things that, you know, and keep them guessing. One of my favorite shots in this, and it's a callback again to Halloween a little bit, is when they're all crowded into the church at the end, and then it's the shot where everybody's kind of in the foreground, but the focus goes all the way to the background, and you see the church window, and if you're watching, you can see the ghost come up to the window and smash it out. You know, so it's there for for the viewer that can that sees it. But, you know, Carpenter knows that we're not looking at that window.
Right, right.
We're looking at the foreground, at the actors. And then, boom, it breaks it out. And it's like, oh, geez. And it's with the focus back there, it's like it's not even a cheat. It was there the whole time. You know, it's creative sort of use of the panel and use of the frame that makes, that to me is always something that elevates the movie. If you don't just light and get away. Don't do the Roger Corman light and get away, you know.
Well also the whole, the temptation must have been so great to have when you have, you know, the priest finding that journal. You know, the temptation to just explain everything with the journal would be so great, you know. I mean, that could tell you everything you need to know. But instead, they just give you a couple little items out of it and let you work from there, you know. Instantly when he found the journal, I was picturing there was going to be something where, like, you know, once you got to the last page of the journal, you found the incantation that you would have to read at a certain time in order to send them back, you know, which they do at the last second, you know. And I was very pleased that nothing like that happened. I love when horror movies like this, where stuff just sort of begins and then it ends, you know. It was a lot of horror movies in the 70s were like that, you know. It's like, here's the setting, here it is in its normal state. Things are crazy, and now things are done being crazy, and let's see who's still alive, you know, and still intact. And that was the movie, you know?
Yeah, that's kind of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre approach, you know?
Yes.
Who will survive and what will be left of them?
Yep, you know, everything doesn't necessarily have to line up or resolve or...
Well, it does resolve. I mean, they do get their revenge.
Yes, in this one they actually complete their revenge. And then at one point I realized that I was like, towards the very end, I was like, well, this movie does lose a little bit of power, because I do, you know, at one point I realized, oh, only six people are going to die in the course of this movie. So once, you know, four or five died, it's like, well, you know, I wonder who the one last person is going to be. And it's pretty, so it was definitely, you weren't expecting a big body count, you know. It wasn't one of those ones where it's like, all right, is anybody going to survive this? Is it going to be one of those, you know, just totally dead-end horror endings or whatever? It's like, no, you know, most of these people are going to survive, but somebody's got to die. And I guess, actually, if you think about it, Jamie Lee Curtis's character must have been, I guess, maybe the safest of all the characters, because perhaps she's not from that town, so, well, they were going to kill her, too.
No, I'm sorry, go ahead, Harold.
Oh, I didn't say anything.
Oh, I was going to say, she's, it's possible because she wasn't from there, but at the same time, you know, when they take the gold cross and they all disappear, she was the one that was being grabbed actively at the time in the back room of the church.
But that's what I would do if I was a ghost, too.
Yeah, well...
I'd be heading for the top of the lighthouse myself.
It's all
just
sorts
you and me, baby. Put on some of that cheesy slow jazz.
Yeah, exactly.
And I love that it's an AM radio station. That I don't know why that, again, it's like the 70s. It's got to be an AM.
Yeah.
AM easy listening jazz station.
Yeah, because AM now is all talk radio, at least where I am.
Oh, yeah. It's all talk by me, too, if you can even get it. Where I grew up in New York, we could get, 660 and 880, which were the two giant stations that broadcast from Manhattan, and that's it. That's all you could get on AM.
Well,
you wanted the sports or you wanted the news. That's pretty much all you get.
Where I am, I'm lucky. I get there's all sorts of stuff. We even have a awesome, insanely awesome country station on... on AM around here that you can get every once in a while that plays old, you know, old country music, just classic old stuff. It's wonderful. Plus, it sounds even more wonderful because it's AM and it's got all the. I love that aspect of it.
Yeah. Hey, actually, you know, it's funny. We were talking about the radio station. Maybe reminded me of this. We were talking about how Carpenter puts all these references in his films. Well, I caught a mention in this film that was later referenced in something else. They talk about the ship. They were saying that they spotted him out by Bodega Bay, or no, he said he saw the sailor up at Bodega Bay a week ago, and that the doctor says that, and he says I'd swear he'd been underwater for a month.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bodega Bay. If you know your direct-to-video 1980s horror film, the Bodega Bay Inn is the name of the inn in the Puppet Master series, which also takes place in a small coastal California town like The Fog.
Oh.
Yeah, so the Bodega Bay Motel, and I'm like, oh, okay, Bodega Bay. And it's like, obviously, Charles Band was a fan of The Fog, so there you go.
God, I saw the first Puppet Master when it first came out, and I haven't seen any, and I barely remember it, but I remember enjoying the hell out of it.
I've seen one of them, the one that's disavowed by the rest of the series, because it's the one with Corey Feldman in it.
Oh, that's enough to disavow anything from, anything.
I've actually got the box set of Puppet Master, which is, I'm glad I bought it, I got it as a gift. I'm glad I did, because now that set had to be recalled and destroyed. Because Charles Band did not own the DVD rights to the first Puppet Master when he published it. So it's like, whoops, but, hey, I've got it. You can pry it out of my cold, dead hands.
Nice,
like
nice.
As you say that, I need to check eBay and see what this thing is going for. I can already tell it's going to be crazy.
Yeah, I mean, the only problem with it is that I think it, let me look. If it has
it
retro...
It might not even be legal for you to sell it on eBay.
You could probably sell. I don't know, but it only, and the thing is, it goes up through retro, so it's got all the original series and then retro tech on there at the end. So it's before they started getting really with the clip show movies. You know, like the one with Corey Feldman, I think is one of the clip show movies, and it's like, okay, that just blows goats. I'm sorry, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's actually not going for that much.
This was a couple of years ago. I think interest has pretty much died down on it at this point. You know. But I remember that at the time that it got recalled, and I don't, you know, and it's like, it's just hilarious. The fact also that the title of the DVD is actually Puppet Master 1, not just Puppet Master, but with the 1 on there. I'm like, oh, that is awesome. That's like, I'm going to release a box set of the Friday the 13th, so just call it Jason 1 through 10, you know.
You know, I mean, you got to make sure the audience knows exactly what's going on. All the other ones have a number in front of it. I don't know. Maybe it's the last one. I don't know. Is it like an ace? I don't know. What do you deal with it? You know, is it like the beginning or at the end? Is it the highest one or the lowest one? I don't know.
It's like the Rambo movies, you know.
That's
true. It goes First Blood, then First Blood, then Rambo, First Blood Part 2, then Rambo 3, then Rambo.
Yeah, they come.
But what are you going to call it if you make a sequel to the last one?
Rambo 2?
Rambo,
I guess?
No, well, now you can do Rambo 2.0.
And no.
I would call it Rambo 2 First Blood Part 5.
Ooh,
there you go.
That would be
there
awesome.
You go.
That would be awesome. Oh my god, that has to be done. You know,
or just Rambo Blood from a Stone.
Yeah. Well, you never know. You might be able to talk Stallone into doing something like that. He's got enough.
I love the way that thing ended. I'm like, you can't do anything else with that character. You can't. The further away from Vietnam you get, the less relevance you have.
Yeah, but that's the wonder of it. Is it doesn't that does not stop him at all.
Yeah, I do admire it, man.
It doesn't even slow him down.
Yeah.
Oh, he's got the HGH now. Come on.
Yeah.
He's too young to slow down. He's got more movies to make.
got to make sequels to The Expendables now.
Absolutely. I want one every 6 months.
I think they're actually filming the second one now, I believe.
I have not had a chance to see that yet. My wife is not a big action movie fan, so that one hasn't come up on the queue yet. But I got to say, just looking at it from the outside in, the 90s crap cinema aficionado in me is disappointed that Van Damme didn't appear in it.
His career was taken off, man. He did JCVD. He was too cool for school.
I understand the JCVD, and I'm hear me out on this. He was the role that Van Damme was supposed to play was the one that Jet Li got. So the character that Van Damme was supposed to play was supposed to be fighting constantly with the guy that Lundgren played. So it's like, okay, soldier baby, it's back on.
See, I didn't know that. Now I'm upset.
I thought that movie had a lot more. It was a decent movie, and it had some great, you know, 80s scenes that, you know, just legitimately felt like an 80s action movie of you know, the guys all armed to the teeth running through the enemy stronghold and slapping bombs on the walls and then running away, and then the whole place blows up.
And the explosion was fucking orgasmic.
And the way they filmed it was very 80s, you know, the whole rhythm of it. But I don't know. I just could have... I thought they could have... There could have been... They could have gone way even more over the top than they did, and it would have been just supremely... I mean, at some point in it, I was like, you know, this is not a realistic movie. They might as well have just gone for it and gone just apeshit crazy. And they do in some aspects of it. There's some aspects of the story that are just ridiculous and crazy. But I could have just, like, used even more just nonstop action. I don't know, but... I was expecting it to be bad. I was actually like thinking that I was going to do a media masochist out of it, and about 10 minutes in I was like, oh no, actually I'm going to enjoy this movie.
It's just a fun ride. I mean, I got everything I wanted out of that movie. It gave me what it was promising.
Yeah.
So I can't be mad.
Well, you know, another movie that delivers on what it promises: The Fog.
The Fog.
Oh, wow. our whole view was getting fogged up. That's the whole thing about The Fog, is it clouds men's minds.
Oh, that's the shadow.
That's the shadow, yeah.
Oh, I thought that was Adrian Barbeau and Jamie Lee Curtis, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Try not to think about them making out.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah. Oh, thank you.
Now I can't stop. Now I can't stop.
That's the only thing. If this was a modern movie, damn it, they would have made out.
Well, I can tell you that the whoever the girl was in the remake of The Fog did not look nearly as good as either of them. So
I'm sure
that alone was a disqualification right there for me.
You see, that's another thing I like about 70s movies is the characters are just always more interesting, you know? I mean, all these, like, Jamie Lee Curtis's character is kind of sketchy in this, but there's no, you know, that's not the focus of her character. If she was a sketchy character in this movie, they would drive it home. They would have had her, like, in his bathroom, like, shooting up heroin or something, you know, and something like that. But, you know, it's just sort of let on that, hey, maybe she's sort of a free love hippie throwback, or maybe she was in California to be in movies and it didn't work out quite the way that she wanted it to, or
well, she was totally hippie. She had the art book with her.
Yeah, that's right.
And she was going to Canada. I mean, who else goes to Canada but hippies and Eskimos and hockey players?
That's right, Canada. That's right. After the Michael Myers lands on her, she's like, I think I'm ready to go to, where was she going? Not Winnipeg or
Vancouver.
Vancouver, yeah. I think I'm ready to go to Vancouver now.
Well, and you know, you talk about that, you know, characters seemed a little bit richer like that. And this is kind of a double-edged sword, because it gets back to what we were saying earlier about beating the audience over the head with it. Well, at the same time, a part of it is that and we've discussed this before, kind of the general 70s cynicism, you know, that you know, is not atypical in 70s films, even large blockbuster films. The remake of King Kong comes to mind for being an extremely cynical film.
Uh-huh.
You know, that everybody is either, you know, a liar or a scumbag, or they're hiding something. They got some kind of skeleton in their closet, and it's almost cliche looking at it now. But at the time, that was kind of you know, nouveau cinema sort of thing, that it wasn't cut and dry, that everybody had a backstory and brought something to the table.
It was like that in music too. That was when the Eagles were one of the greatest bands, and all their songs were cynical songs of moral degradation and stuff like that.
Yeah. And that cynicism is kind of what brings that. It's like, well, you know, she's a hitchhiker. She's got to be shady.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, but, you know, everybody has their own, everybody's got their problems. You know, it's like, because we're all, you know, all of us are damaged goods.
Right, well, there was absolutely no judgment on any of the characters, you know. Like, the councilwoman was a little bit shady, or not shady, but she was just sort of like, you know, power bitchy, you know, and sort of mean to her personal assistant sort of thing. And, you know, and the guys out in the trawler were, you know, sloppy drunks and stuff like that. But I love the 70s portrayed characters like that. They just let them be, you know. They were just, here's their character. Okay, this guy's drunk, because sometimes you have these guys who go out on the fishing boats and they're drunks, you know. And in this movie, one of these guys, they would have connected them getting killed with them being drunk, you know.
Right.
In some way. Or
There was a lot more of the 70s, especially towards the later half, you know, what I like to deem, you know, 76 kind of through 79, even spilling over into the early 80s, there was that kind of moral relativism, especially in entertainment, where it's like, you know, hey man, you're not hurting anybody, you know, that kind of BS. And that, again, that's kind of what we see here too. It's like they simply are, you know, that's what they are, and that's what the character is. And there's no moralizing or moral judgment given.
Yeah, it doesn't really come into the play of the story at all. You know,
I mean, again, I mentioned the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong. You know, Charles Grodin in that, you know, that movie's made modern times. He gets stepped on, not his hat. Well, he does get stepped on, that's right. In the original script, he didn't get stepped on. And audiences hated him so much, they made him step on him. But I'm getting on a tangent about Kong stepping on people, so I'm going to stop.
Someday we really got to do that. The Kong remake and the sequel to the Kong remake.
Oh, King Kong Lives.
Which is one of the bloodiest, craziest big monkey movies ever made.
I go with the bloodiest, the craziest big monkey movie ever made is either King Kong Escapes, which was made by Toho in 1967, uh-huh. Or there's a Korean movie called Ape. Ape, it's A star, P star, E star, like MASH.
I'm familiar with Ape.
Yeah, then, okay, if you're familiar with Ape, then I don't need to go on.
There was a time when I first got a computer that I could video edit on. The first thing I did was, for whenever I would need background video for a band or my band, I made a two-hour movie called The Monkey Movie that basically was Ape. It was the sequel to the King Kong Lives. And another one that was, I believe it was like maybe Korean, American, and Indian production, and Tarantino's company.
Mighty Peking Man?
Yes, Mighty Peking Man. And I took all three of those movies and sort of combined them into like one. I took out everything but the monkeys. I just took all the scenes with the monkeys doing monkey things. And if there were people in them, they were just because they were in them with the monkeys. And I tried to re-edit it into something that sort of made some sort of sense, that was about, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours of monkeyness, and I just called it the Monkey Movie, and I used to use that all the time. It was awesome. And Ape was just one of my, there's a sublime scene in Ape where he runs into a schoolyard full of little kids. It's like a ballet of beautiful brilliance to me.
Does he eat them?
No, He dances. It's just the combination of the music, and I've heard that the movie is actually in 3D. I just happened to turn on the TV late one night when I could watch the TV through my computer, and I was flipping through the channels, and I was just like, whoa, what's this? And like hit record. It's a giant monkey. And it wasn't until, you know, afterwards that I did some internet searches that I found out what the name of the movie was and that it was originally in 3D.
Yeah, it says on the wiki page, and I got to read this because it says one of the alternate titles for it is Attack of the Giant Horny Gorilla.
Yep.
That fucking says it all. And the mother from Growing Pains is in it, so now I have to see it.
Highly recommend it. It's very much like this movie called The Fog.
Oh,
yeah.
Carpenter.
Yeah.
Which
what else can we say about The Fog?
Any final... Do I have a final thought or I finish up my notes? No, I mentioned the last thing I was going to say. So, anybody got any final notes before we give our closing thoughts here?
I'm just very pleased that this movie that I haven't seen since it ever came out is it's the first time I saw it that I was way I was thinking I thought it would be fun but like kind of disappointing, but it was a completely engaging movie. It was just awesome. It's awesome to see it's like seeing a new John Carpenter movie, but with all the hot old stars of the old times. The only other one that's going to be sort of like that is Memoirs of an Invisible Man. I don't really remember much about that movie at all.
I remember too much of it.
So that's about all I have to say with it. Yep. I was very, very pleasantly surprised since our Halloween podcast, maybe I've been like having a little more of a soft spot for ghost stories too. So it was good to see a really classic old ghost story.
Yep. And let me add to that as we've talked about on this episode, this is this film doesn't have any gore in it. It doesn't have any, you know, sex. It has a little bit of profanity, but it's not, you know, nothing really like questionable. So, you know, this is very much a film you can watch in mixed company. If you're looking for a horror movie, if you're looking for a ghost story, if you're looking for a John Carpenter movie, you know, and you don't want to break out Halloween, and you don't want to, you know, just send people running to the barf bags with The Thing or something like that, The Fog is a great option for that because it's a great little movie that will, you know, you'll remember it after you watch it, but it's not going to, you know, it's not going to offend anybody who watches it.
It might be a good first John Carpenter movie for your kids, or at least a first John Carpenter horror movie that you could show your kids when you're starting to think maybe your kids are old enough for horror movies. This would be a good one because it would be intense without crossing super gore lines. And it also has a little kid in it, which also gives kids something to sort of identify with, and the little kid does not get killed horribly, so it wouldn't be too traumatic.
Yeah, he gets put in danger, but not killed, yes. So that's usually good. So
yeah,
you can't put kids in peril anymore.
God.
What a shame. Yeah, I was just gonna. The only final thought I have is this movie ascribes to what every horror movie basically should do: keep it simple, stupid,
yep.
Just roll on, set it up, hit your beats. Race to the end.
Yeah, I'll agree with that. This movie doesn't waste any time. There's nothing extraneous to the story. There's nothing that it doesn't need that is just sort of thrown in there. It's lean and mean. Lean, mean ghost story machine. So excellent. And next week or whenever we get it, as soon as we can watch it and get it to you, it's going to be They Live.
Just put on the fucking glasses.
Oh my God, this is going to be an awesome show. I have we might even have a guest, my friend Mike Cross, who I've known since I was in middle school is when I first met him. And he's been basically listened to every Two True Freaks show since the beginning.
Yeah.
Which is funny because I just never would take him for being interested in a lot of the subject matter that we talk about, but I know the horror stuff he's into, and he was saying, if you ever do They Live, I want in on that one, so I'm going to try and pull him in. I love that movie.
And the thing about They Live is that it's so ripe with subtext and commentary that is never going to go out of fashion.
Yeah, and it's
no matter what your political, economic, social, moral beliefs are, you always feel somebody's out to screw with them.
Yes,
and you know? and ultimately, that's what makes They Live relevant. I am predicting a golden age that will begin with us watching They Live, because this is just such a great movie that, as far as people growing up, like Hero and I's age, you know, growing up in the 80s with Rowdy Roddy Piper in it, you know, and it's John Carpenter and Roddy Piper, and it's so the iconic imagery of They Live. It's like this podcast is gonna drop a 50 megaton bomb on all your other podcasts.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The rest, internet people, you watch out, because the Vault part like Monster Horror tells the terror is coming to get you.
Yeah, I'm gonna come ready with this one. I might have some like David Icke and Alex Jones style conspiracy theory quotes, you know, ready for this one and stuff. The impact this movie's had on our culture has just been amazing and hilarious, and it just awesome. So you, unless you're coming to this late, you're gonna have to wait, but damn, it's going to be a good show. So be back for, God, that'll be like our seventh episode.
Yep. And let me just add, is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream?
Well said.
Nice.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com. where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass. And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled ScottGardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Two True Freaks has been brought to you today by Damanzo Core of Milan, Italy, and by the letters F and U.